I'm very excited because I'm getting to talk to one of my favorite writers, Colin Fleming, who joins us on the line. Good afternoon, Colin.
Hey, how's it going, buddy?
It's going well. It's going well. I was sitting for a while this afternoon with one of my colleagues up at the university, my friend Henry Garfield, who's a quite a great writer. Speculative fiction is his specialty, and he's had some novels with some major places. And we were talking about how much reading informs what people become as writers, people that have read difficult and interesting books. And I thought to myself of how many books I've told people about that sort of flew under the popular radar that they've come back to me and said, that really means something to me. That's why I thought we'd talk about some of those today. And I was thinking maybe you might go first and give us a book that you really admire that probably most people do not know.
I don't know if reading necessarily has to inform writing, though. I'll be honest. I usually find reading pretty boring, which sounds strange maybe for me of all people to say that, but I think there are all kinds of ways to write that don't have anything to do with reading. I think a lot of times reading becomes imitating for many people, and something that I increasingly say more often is the world will give you stories. Now, learning how to deploy language, that's different, but I think that's something that you're born with, like a sense of music, and you have to work to hone that. But I, of course, have recommendations for it's kind of a funny qualification, books that people might not know, because there really aren't, right? You can name almost anything. People,
right. Know. And I was thinking about how especially when I was younger, there were certain short stories that I read that said to me, I want to write a short story because I read those kind of short stories. There is that imitative thing that can start at the beginning. But I think there are a lot of books that really deserve wider audiences, and for all the reasons they're not there. One of my, I don't think I've ever read a better novel than The Story of Lucy Galt by William Trevor. It's a very sad book in many ways, but it's one of the most human books I've ever read. I've always been a big fan of Trevor's. And when I give it to people, sometimes they'll say, oh, I can't read that. It's too bleak. And other people will say to me, that book really moved me in a way, made me see things differently. And that's sort of what I'm thinking about. Not so much what it does for a writer, per se, but what it does for someone who becomes a reader.
Yeah, a book that I like quite a bit, people don't really know it. It's called Diary of a Provincial Lady. This is part of a series. It was written by E.M. Delafield. And it's simply a diaristic account of an upper middle class woman in England in the late 1920s. And it kind of speaks to that idea that I was talking about, where that is the novel. And this person goes about the business of their life. And it might seem at first that it could only be humdrum, that there's not going to be pyrotechnics to this life. It's the management of a household, really. It's sort of Downton Abbey-ish that way, but without that level of wealth and quite the same amount of privilege. And yet the narrative, it builds. We get this voice and we go from entry to entry to entry. And there are almost these mini chapters, they're larger than vignettes, but they all add up in the way that the scope of a life adds up into a kind of story to someone who's engaged in living, who's present in that life. And it's the type of thing, too, that it's not a hard read. I think oftentimes people think, oh, no, reading, it's going to be like homework, it's so boring. And I absolutely understand that, because most of what you're told to read is truly tedious and terrible. This is not. It's lively and sprightly, and I don't really recommend books to people, but that would be one that I would suggest they check out.
I've always felt that I'm a big fan of Elizabeth Strout's work. I have every book she's ever written, and I find her to be really great. She wrote a book. Her second novel is called Abide With Me. It's a story of a young guy who's a minister in a small town in Maine, and there are secrets, and there are tragedies, and there are rumors, and it is so small-town perfect without driving that in your face. And it's funny because once she won the Pulitzer Prize, all the books after that have become really, really well read. And I would say that her two first books sort of meet in that same place. And I like what you said, that the books that are about a life. You know, I feel that way about The Colony of Unrequited Dreams by Wayne Johnson, a Newfoundland writer, which is, it's just, all of his work is just stunning. And I'm not normally a historical novel fan. You know, that's, historical novels not what I go for, but his are really, really good. And I think people who would be wise to read to learn a little bit about the structure. You don't need to learn about structure. You know everything there is about structure. But I think for a lot of people who are wondering about how do I become a writer, some of these books will maybe help them see what, how big the challenge is, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
I think a key takeaway from something you read that's worth the time of reading and the energy that goes into reading, it's a bit different. I would say that it has to feel like you're not reading, that you're not conscious of reading in and of itself is, I spoke of the humdrum. It's kind of a humdrum act unless it's transcended, if it becomes this other sort of life experience. So when I talk about like the life quotient of a work, I don't mean the temporal scope of, I always get so bored with books and stories where they go from generation to generation and you're never in a kind of moment. It's almost like the thing that people were so into a ways back, genealogy, not the name of it. And so much prose to me reads like that. And you can have a book that's 5 minutes temporally out of a life that conveys maybe not the actual scope of that life itself, but of life itself beyond that individual's own existence. And so like a novel, I mean, it's used to be well known. It's not maybe well known anymore. It's better known as a film and now as a Netflix series. But Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House from 1959 always stood out to me. And the reason it stands out is because when you think about the horror medium, the ghost story medium, it's usually not in the novelistic form. It's usually in the short form, because what ghost story writers almost invariably do is they just try to give you a mood. Even M.R. James, he's giving you a mood, and a mood passes. The mood isn't sustainable, and the mood doesn't really have legs as more than a mood. So The Haunting of Hill House is a ghost story. It's a classic haunted house story, but it's not really a haunted house story. It's really about this woman in particular, Eleanor, and where she has been parted from herself, her identity in her own life, and trying to navigate and locate that unsuccessfully, that identity again. So it's something, in a way, it's all about ghosts and spooks and all this stuff, but there's more realism in it, like befitting a Frank Norris, almost, someone like that.
Right. And I thought a really interesting thing you just said there, I had written down Shirley Jackson with a question mark. People will know her story, The Lottery, and they will have read it in high school, and they will think, well, that's an interesting story. And then go to look around and talk to their teachers in the libraries and ask about Shirley Jackson. And they're not going, and mostly they're not going to find those books in the high school libraries, you know, like The Haunting and stuff. And that's why I think it's important sometimes to talk about books like that, so that people get a chance to read something that's just so much better than the other stuff that they're told is like that. You know, there's an incredible book called A Century of November by Walter Weatherill, who's a great writer as far as I'm concerned, and not all that well known. It's a story that takes place, it begins during World War I. A farmer in Vancouver learns that his son has been killed in Belgium and decides that he has to go to see where he died, in part because the farmer has also just lost his wife to the Spanish flu. I don't want to give away the plot of A Century of November, but it is one of the most human novels, and it's almost as if 1 year becomes a lifetime. That what you're talking about, that temporal part of writing. Is there another book you can think of? Maybe like maybe not A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, but a book which, Ulysses obviously takes place over 24 hours, but a smaller book that does that well, that gives us a big view of a small time?
I don't know what a small time is, though. I mean, that's the thing. I think I used to, quite a while ago, I thought in terms of units of measurement. I think if you want to write well, you have to dispense with what you think you know about the units of measurement.
Yeah.
Whether it's just with length, with word count. I mean, someone's 5,000 word count isn't the same. Well, nowadays it is. It's the same as everyone else's 5,000 word count. Everyone writes the same way. But like someone else can have three words that might as well be three volumes if they're the right words, if they're the words that fit contextually, if they're the words that transcend the reading experience and give you a life experience. But I like that idea of unity of time, place, and action. But once you master the possibilities of that concept, you can realize that even that is malleable. You can... This is what the story is going to be about. This person sets out to meet this person here at this spot in the city. They're not just going to meet that person at that spot in the city. They might be going back into their own past. They might be going into what they want their future to be and why it won't reach that level in their mind, that kind of thing. So you still have that unity of time, place, and action, but you're in all these different vistas simultaneously. And that's really with something in a digressive way that Ulysses is. You're in all these different headspaces and vistas. Now, that's like a maximalist example of it. And I would say that someone who was a better writer would have been able to do it without having to take the maximalist approach. And that was also someone, too, who was having a big sort of piss take on critics and readers and hyper-conscious of that in his letters. So it might not have been the most pure Finnegan's way too, the purest of endeavors, but that tight cohesion can come in like a 10,000 word story. It can come in a prolix book, but you're in that, you're always in the moment. And I think that's the key to writing well too. I mean, they dovetail. To write well, like my sort of stock advice, which no one thinks of, is you have to be entirely present. And that doesn't mean like, oh, I'm not just looking at my phone. You have to be absorbed into that world and into those mindsets of those characters.
And that's what I'm not trying to blow smoke up your skirts, but that's what I find so great about your short fiction, is that I'm in the moment, I'm in quickly, and I'm out when the time has come to be out. The story ends where it should end. And so much of what I read these days takes, they just spin their wheels. There are five beginnings to every story. Oh, yeah. It's two pages later and I'm, you know, especially when I'm working on American fiction, I'm going, well, I guess this one isn't going to make it. That presence is I think there was a time in American fiction where it was there to a greater degree, but as you look around, there have to be some other writers these days that you know you think are doing a pretty decent job at that. Are there any of like if you were to say to someone who's read all of your books and they want to read some more short fiction, where would you direct them?
Right now?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't think there's anyone in the world who writes well right now.
I thought you were going to say no, but I meant right. If you were going to tell them to look back, even if you were just going to say, look, I mean, I always tell people Liam O'Flaherty wrote 371 short stories, and about 360 of them are not all that good. But the 11 that are really good are really, really good.
Oh, sure. Like, and if you read something by him, like The Conger Eel, you wouldn't think that could be like a story. It's just kind of like an eel that's hooked.
Yeah.
He's had a bad day. That's like sort of what you, predator-wise, the only thing that can get you if you're that eel is like the man in the boat. And the story is simply what happens to that eel during the course of that action. And you would think, like, well, an eel can't think. It can't cogitate like a human. But it becomes something more. And it doesn't, like, descend into this sort of campy metaphor or anything like that. It stands out as something efficient and riveting. But you know what? When I'm reading, I'm never not reading. But it can take forms of so many different kinds of things. But like I had mentioned on your Facebook, when I was in second, third grade, the things that I read, the things that I was open to as literature in a way, it could be Please Please Me by the Beatles. It could be a Peanuts cartoon and the cadences and the vulnerability of the characters. It could be the way an early season episode of Cheers was written and brought to life, like circa 1985. It could have been a Sandy Koufax Scholastic biography that wasn't really for adults, but you could read it when you were in third, fourth, fifth grade, that type of thing. It's the prevailing openness, I'd say, rather than, oh, go read this by this person that these other writers are talking about. None of that. Anytime I looked at that stuff, T.C. Boyle, it's terrible. I was never interested in it. And then you have all these people who write the exact same way. And now, as of November, they're all being replaced. I can't believe more people are not talking about this by AI, where I'm seeing stories now that's written by a computer. You just plug in what you want it to say, and it comes out in the style of this person who has this one sort of vanilla go-to style. I mean, so many writers have contributed to making themselves obsolete, and it's like the machines are really starting to gain a toehold right now.
Yeah, I'm very, as someone who teaches literature, it worries me greatly that we're going to see more and more papers that have been generated by a computer through someone using keywords and keystrokes. That what I really love is many of my friends are saying, well, that's the end of homework. You're going to have these things in class. You're going to write them out by hand. We're gonna beat the machine. We're going to become Luddites. But I also, you know, you made a really good point a second ago that I think a lot of people miss, and that's you could read the back of a baseball card as a piece of literature when you're young.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And you could.
I think at any age, if you understand, when I had that book come out, Brackets, it starts with a version of the back of the baseball card.
Yep.
The first story is takes the form of a couple grocery lists, and that tells. The world wants to give you narrative, but like if I look at the back of Dave Kingman's baseball card, or I go to Baseball Reference, and I know what those numbers mean because that numerical knowledge has been imparted to me. As a writer can impart what their quote unquote numbers, their symbols, their words are going to mean. They're going to set that up. They're going to signpost. I can look at Dave Kingman one year and see that he hit 202, but he led the league in home runs. And I know a lot about Dave Kingman's psyche and his mindset when he was going up to the plate because he was thinking, I don't care if I whiff four times today. I might jack one, but
right.
I can fall over the rest of the time. And that's not like really a team first attitude. It kind of gives you some insight into Dave Kingman and how this guy was smashing 30 home runs every year, but he's bouncing around the league like crazy because he's just this sort of like malcontent who lives for nothing but the home run between the white lines. So yeah, that's narrative if you understand something like that.
Oh yeah, I love if I find a dropped grocery list in the grocery store. I love to see what's on that list, and then imagine in my head who it was that was shopping for those items, and it'll make a difference to me whether I found it on a Saturday or I found it on a Monday because I try to get into the mindset, and I think that's one of the things that unfortunately, since people have been deciding they should in the fourth grade start teach creative writing by teaching people how they're supposed to do it instead of allowing them the chance to learn how to do it. That's really changed. I mean, people will do found list. They'll see a list and make it a found poem. But I'd much rather try and figure out in my brain what the story is, what the story is in that list and who the person in that story is about.
Well, it's also how they start. You mentioned the prevarication that's so dominant at the start of almost every fiction you read right now. Advice that I would give to people is that whatever you're doing on page 3 or 4 or whenever it is, probably move that up to the first line.
Yeah.
Because it just goes on and on and then adjust. But like as a sort of tip, that would be one that I would try to employ because what you end up with is these stories that begin with throat clearing, and Preamble. But then the entire story becomes Throat Clearing and Preamble. And if you somehow, you don't have to read it. You can jump, you can skip, and it doesn't really matter. You can just take a couple pages off and look at the end and go, that's kind of what I saw. Like, the whole thing is non-story, and it's also very teachable to do something like that. Orson Welles, he talked about the difference between movies and theater. He said when you do theater, people are coming in, they're settling down. You don't have to start at the top of your bent. That was the phrase he used. He said, when you do movies, you always have to start at the top of your bent. You have to bring people in. You think about the beginning of that long, continuous take at the start of Touch of Evil, how Citizen Kane begins with the sort of the dissolves. We go through the fence. We go into the mansion. We see the death of the main character. We've started, especially there, at the top of the bent. You have to do the same thing with fiction. That doesn't mean you have like a sentence that begins with 14 exclamation points to lead off. But you have to pull people in because think about this. There is nothing easier to do than to stop reading something. And there's nothing harder to do than to write artfully. And negotiating those two extremes is what's going to make someone a great writer or not. So if you say to me, who would you recommend right now? That's why I can say nobody, because I don't think anybody comes close to doing anything like that. But stopping reading something is even easier than changing the station on the TV. Like, the remote might be across, like, the couch from you. I'm like, I don't want to really get up. Reading is just close the book or click out of it and move into something else. Nothing is easier. And you always have to be thinking of the reader that way. And no writers do. They're not thinking of readers at all, especially people in MFA programs. But you always have to be thinking, how is this person on the other side of the table reacting? What are they thinking? Are they engrossed? You work for them as the writer. And I think very few people understand that.
That's why I always finish off my creative writing classes by saying, if you're in this class, or start it by saying, if you're in this class because you want to write for yourself, that's diary, that's journaling. We're not here for that. And
that's fine in and of itself.
Exactly.
That's a different thing.
But that's why I try and tell them that's a different thing, and you may be really good at that. But if you don't have a reader in mind all the time, you're probably not going to go that well. You know, I wish we had 2 hours to do this, because I really like talking to you about this, and I feel like I learn something every time. But unfortunately, we got to wrap up here. Is there said something very close to what Vonnegut said about 30 pages into your novel, go back and throw out the first six. It took you that long to get going. You have an incredible ability in your first and second sentence to draw people in. Do you usually have that sentence at the beginning, or does it sometimes do you find it 6 or 8 sentences in?
No, that hasn't happened in about 10 years that I've done the moving up thing. And I didn't do it often. I did it with a story called First Responder, but no, I haven't. I just do it. And I found I'm writing more than ever, which doesn't seem possible, but I'm doing less of it. Like with my fingers, I just sort of open myself up and everything's going to come to me in time. And then the actual, here I am, the keyboard, there's not a lot of wasted, even physical motion. But again, I'm hyper-conscious of these things. I'm aware of what the first sentence has to do. And if you just, an interesting exercise, if people are out there and they want to write or whatever, you want to share this with someone, go look at literary journals and just find 10 random stories and isolate the first sentence of each. Look at them, put them on a page, copy and paste into a Word document, and you're going to stare at those 10 sentences and just go, blah.
And they're all the same sentence. Yes. Well, Colin,
they're all going to be the same.
Oh, yeah, I know. That's why I don't read many of them anymore. Colin, thank you for being with us, especially for adjusting on the fly to me being here and Rich not being here. People, if you don't have Colin Fleming's books, buy them all. I have every one I think you can buy. I've learned something from all of them, and always grateful to have you on the show, my friend.
Okay, thanks a lot, sir.
All right, we'll see you, Colin. host, author Colin Fleming. And I'm serious. If you want great short fiction, you need to read Colin Fleming's work. He's as good as we've turned out ever, I think. And always glad to have him on.